Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. The Wisconsin Supreme Court hears arguments in a lawsuit about the separation of powers. Plus, lawmakers advance a bill that would let UW-Madison pay student-athletes. And conservative Justice Annette Ziegler announces she'll retire, setting up another open court race. All that and more on Rewind, your week in review for March 13th.
I'm Anjevin Wagtendonk.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Welcome to Rewind. Big week of a lot of legal and court-related stories. So we will start with oral arguments in the Supreme Court in the case, the latest case that is called Wisconsin State Legislature versus Josh Call. There have been several of those. This one is about multi-state settlement funds. So this goes all the way back to the lame duck laws that were passed on the eve of the Evers governorship. And at the core of this lawsuit is kind of this question of, does the legislature control the money that comes out of multi-state lawsuits, or does the DOJ, does the Attorney General? So right now, this money is supposed to go into the general fund. The legislature sued Call over this in 2021. They said that he's putting it into a DOJ account or an account that he controls. He won that case in circuit court, lost in appeals court, written by Maria Lazar, who is running for Supreme Court. And so we will just, before we kind of get into all the details, we will take a look at some of the arguments from earlier this week.
It doesn't belong to the Department of Justice, right? Who does this money belong to?
That's correct. It belongs, it's state money just as...
It's not state money. It belongs to the people of Wisconsin. And the Constitution specifically authorizes and empowers the legislature as the people's representatives to say where the people's money will be spent.
We can debate the wisdom of that, but for large amounts of money to be sitting in appropriations without expenditure authority. And if the legislature wants those monies to go elsewhere, it can do that, but it has to do that by law.
That's exactly the kind of thing that this new statute is designed to end, and have that money go into the general fund and then for general revenue purposes, and then the legislature can decide whether it wants to appropriate that money. It's not an attorney general's decision in the context of a settlement negotiation to decide where the people's money will go.
Right, so there's this question of just who controls that money, where is that money supposed to go, and the legislature is saying that it's the people's money, it's meant to go to something that the legislature has authority over.
It's also a question of, is it what the legislature wrote or what it meant? And what I mean by that is, yes, the legislature wrote in 2018 that this money should go to the general fund. They meant the general fund that they control. Josh Call argues these accounts where he's putting the money are part of the general fund. They're under that umbrella, they're just in DOJ. He can't spend that money without legislative approval, but he's meeting the spirit of the law because they said the general fund, not which part of the general fund. It's splitting hairs, I know, but this all goes back to an effort in 2018 that Scott Walker lost, Brad Schimmel lost, Tony Evers has come to the office as governor, Josh Call is the attorney general. Republicans wanted to kind of undercut some of their authority, take some more from them. Now, Republicans argued at the time, what would have happened if Walker had won? People skeptical of that, but said it was all part of this effort to, okay, we're going to do these things ahead of these changes to try and have a more oversight of DOJ, and we've been fighting about it ever since it happened.
Right, so it seems kind of wonky, but it is kind of the latest lawsuit that is about these separation of power questions dating back mm-hmm. to some of those lame duck laws. So there was one last summer about civil settlements and who has authority there. The unanimous decision in that case was that the Attorney General has authority over civil settlements. And then actually there was a kind of related lawsuit that was filed this week also about lame duck laws. This was a Law Forward lawsuit, so that's a progressive law firm here in Madison. And another kind of lame duck change was... allowed the legislature to hire private lawyers without oversight from the governor or the legislature. And so essentially this lawsuit argues that this amounts to a lot of wasteful spending. They say $26 million on private lawyers since 2019, and they say that this puts public dollars towards partisan ends.
Yeah, I began tracking legal bills legislature shortly after Josh Call and Tony Evers took office and seeing the growth private attorneys. They could have hired, so Misha Setlin, who's like regularly a Republican attorney for legislature.
Including in the case that we just were
former Solicitor General. They could have paid him $500,000 a year, and they would have saved money compared to what they're doing right now. That said, you look at it, the increase, it was for everything from election lawsuits. Now, a lot of these cases, they were sued. It wasn't because they were going out looking for actions, but their lawsuits over Act 10, for example, or not Act 10, but the lame duck lawsuit, lame duck laws. There were election lawsuits in 2020. They were getting sued about a lot of stuff, so they hired outside counsel. There's actually, if you go through those legal bills, there's a retainer in the Senate for somebody to keep track of their private attorneys that they're hiring. Like, that's actually in the contract what their responsibility is. That said, so I tracked him for a long time. The Journal sent me a great story updating it last summer, about $26 million. What I'm looking for is, once this goes to discovery, what's the new total? I haven't checked in a while. I've been kind of busy with other stuff. But it is an expense I've been racking up. It's all because there's a Republican-controlled legislature and Democratic Attorney General. Now, that's an interesting question. What might happen after November? You can go through all kinds of scenarios where, if there's a Democratic governor and a Republican Attorney General, who's the governor going to go to for stuff? If there's a mix between the legislature is split and the offices of AG and governor split, who are they going to go to? So we could see more private bills being racked up going forward, depending on how things turn out this fall.
Yeah, they kind of alluded to two high-profile uses of private attorneys. So one being this case in Green Bay a couple of years ago, where the Green Bay City Hall had cameras and recording devices out in the hallway. The state Senate sued about that, but then they were dropped as a plaintiff, but the state Senate kept paying the legal fees for that. So that was one, and that argument was kind of that was a wasteful use of those dollars. And then the other one, of course, is the Gableman investigation, which racked up, I believe, $1.5 million in legal fees, including legal fees to deal with some of the issues that came up over the course of the investigation. And so those were kind of the big named things in the lawsuit. And the GOP response from Voss, who was involved in the Gableman investigation, of course, and LeMahieu, who was involved in the Green Bay situation, the response: the legislature hires attorneys to defend Wisconsin's laws because the people of Wisconsin deserve a rigorous defense of the laws on the books. Even though the attorney general can defend our laws, we have seen that the Department of Justice is unable to put politics aside on partisan issues. So once again, we kind of always had this back and forth of our side is fair and according to the law, and their side is partisan. And then the other side, of course, says the
same
thing.
Trying to mention some sufficient versus some certain. So some certain means you get X dollars to do things. Some sufficient, whatever you need. The legislature is a sum sufficient appropriation, which is why they have to budget for these illegal bills, by the way. They actually, in one budget, I think in 2021 or 23, put a marker of $10 million for legal fees, but it didn't matter. They just spent what they wanted to spend.
Yeah, so we will see kind of how that plays out. And that's another kind of argument in the case, is that it is unlimited. And so it's just sort of, is it a checkbook for whoever's in charge of the legislature? More legal news this week. Former Chief Justice Annette Ziegler announced that she will be retiring. So if she were not, she would be on the ballot next year up for re-election for her third term. But instead, she announced on Monday that after 3 decades on the bench, right now is the right time for me to step away to spend more time with my husband, kids and grandkids. I will therefore not be seeking re-election to the Wisconsin Supreme Court in 2027. So that sets up yet another wide open race, similar to what's happening this spring when Rebecca Bradley said she wouldn't run again, another conservative. This is going to set up maybe a kind of similar situation next spring.
So the question I heard this week was, why now? So there have been rumors for months that she's not going to run. She's 62, the end of her second tenure term on the bench. Believe it or not, she's unopposed in 2017. That would never happen.
Actually, unbelievable. That's right.
Spent 10 years in Washington County bench. People have kind of been talking about she's not going to run. So why now? Well, there might be three reasons people told me. Number one, Marie Lazar is running for Supreme Court in April against Chris Taylor. Chris Taylor is heavily favored right now, just looking at the ad buys and spending. So if Lazar were to lose as a conservative candidate, you don't look like you're reacting to that, like you're afraid to run again. So that's one reason why you'd announce now. Two, you might be goosing the conservative coalition of, hey, you guys better start gearing up because we've got, you know, Rebecca Bradley announced in August of last year she's not going to run for another 10-year term. I'm not running. There's a problem here. Get your stuff together. And three, just to get out of the way, you know, and also get other people, if you want to run, give them a longer runway. Bradley, last April after Susan Crawford won, I interviewed her like right away after that. She said, I'm going to run next year. That was the perception. She's going to run. Then in July, she reported no fundraising first half of the year. Then it took her till end of August to announce she's not going to run. That compressed the window for somebody else to get in. Annette, by doing this, is given a longer runway of, okay, you guys have more time now to figure out, do you want to run in my place in 2027?
And we should note, you know, no matter who wins in next month's Supreme Court election, liberals will hold on to their control. And so it's not a sort of ideological stakes kind of battle. It ends up just being about shoring up the liberal majority or not. And so conservatives maybe don't want to be in the minority. Rebecca Bradley basically said as much in her announcement that she wasn't going to run again, that she could sort of tackle conservative issues in a more effective way elsewhere. Ziegler, I noted, did not sort of use such partisan language. She talked about having support from a broad spectrum of political leaders, both the Democrats and Republicans, who believed in my commitment to fairness, ethics, and the rule of law. So different approaches to talking about where they're going next.
Her race in 2007, honest to gosh, the whole contest was she was a judge and Linda Clifford wasn't. Like, that was basically the whole thrust of the conversation. Now, Ziegler also got dinged because she had heard cases while she was on the bench involving a bank where her husband was an executive of some sort or some kind of role with it. So there were some ethics questions too. But the big ad was against Linda Clifford, her saying in a debate, I'm not a judge, never have been one. Imagine that today.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I have never lived in a Wisconsin that didn't have record-breaking high court races. But this one has slowed down a little bit. So we have some of the numbers about campaign spending to date. Chris Taylor has vastly outraised Marie Lazar. And actually, Taylor's numbers approach where Crawford's were this time last year. So $2.5 million compared to about a tenth of that for Lazar. Chris Taylor is also backed by A Better Wisconsin Together, which has spent quite a bit. ACLU just announced this $450,000 ad buy. And then they both are also getting a certain amount of independent expenditures. But what do you make of the numbers that we're seeing so far?
The conservative cavalry is not coming from Marie Lazar so far. So these numbers are from Ad Impact, which tracks ad buys on TV, radio. Looking at the big ones, I see Chris Taylor, $2.5 million on her own. Better Wisconsin Together, about $1.2 million. So that's a big bulk of what's going on the left. Marie Lazar, 258-ish, not a lot of money compared to the speaking. And then the independent expenditures are from filings with the state, and they show you who's spending money, what they're doing, and who they're supporting. I found one expenditure so far for Lazar, it was $40,000 by Restoration PAC, which is a Dick Uline aligned group. The question I'm asked is, why bother at $40,000? Now, that might be just what's in the bottom of Dick's change drawer. I don't know. He's one of the biggest donors of Republican politics in the country. But there's not a concerted effort financially to help Lazar right now. Politics are driven by money, right? If you don't have money, you don't have a campaign. And so Lazar is really struggling financially, which is why the perception is that Taylor's in a pretty strong position to win come April 7th.
Well, one of the things also that we've seen in these races is that the political parties get involved because they can raise unlimited money, funnel it into campaigns. And the Republican Party did not file a pre-primary report. So we have kind of old numbers from them. But I checked in, and they said that they haven't done any pass-throughs or reportable pass-throughs yet. And so the March 30th deadline, I think, will also give us a sense of how much is coming from the parties. But I also just kind of went through and looked at the big names that were or were not present in the various party filings. So like last year, George Soros, J.B. Pritzker, Reid Hoffman for the Democrats, obviously Elon Musk for the Republicans. This year, only George Soros, and he gave $750,000 compared to $2 million last year. No Pritzker, a lot less from Reid Hoffman. And then Diane Hendricks for the Republicans gave $800,000 compared to $3.6 million last year. So obviously different stakes this time around. Again, the ideological majority isn't at play. And so I think we're seeing that reflected in who's coming through and who's not.
And for Democrats, they're going, okay, we've run four of the last five races by 10 points. We have a governor's race in November that is really important. We're not going to spend one dime more on this race. We have to. So if they can get by on, I want to say, like $5-10 million, which is a lot of money to me, they'll do it. Now, that leaves a door open, though, that if a Dick Uline, a Diane Hendricks, or a coalition of big donors said, we're going to spend $5 million last week's of the race to help Marie Lazar, it could change everything. Now, it's not just money. You have to have infrastructure, which means boots on the ground, people doing doors, handing out literature, et cetera, et cetera. But if you want to do a messaging battle and get to even Steven, it's not hard if you have enough of a checkbook to do it. And that's the kind of paranoia among Democrats I talked to is, we remember Brian Hagedorn. In 2019, Lisa Neubauer was perceived to be like in a commanding lead over Hagedorn. At the end of the race, a bunch of money came in for Hagedorn, and it was a low turnout race, like 1.2 million people voted overall. And conservatives like kind of backlash against this Neubauer message and turn out for Hagedorn, while Neubauer tried to play this I'm more of a nonpartisan card, didn't give Democrats a real like clear signal of I'm your person, and they didn't turn out. Democrats say it's not going to happen this time. They are fully aware of what happened in 19. They are talking to their voters. They are confident they've got their stuff together for 2026.
Yeah, I think there's no dog whistling anymore. It's just kind of whistling. And then our final piece of big court news is Brad Schimmel, who was appointed interim U.S. attorney in the Eastern District in November. And he said he would hope that that would become a permanent appointment. It was announced this week that it will not be made a permanent appointment. The federal judges in Milwaukee would have had to extend to that, essentially. They said they're not. They said that it's not passing judgment on his performance, but that they are sort of like kicking the issue. So what exactly happened, and then what do you think is next?
So we have what's called a Federal Nominating Commission in Wisconsin, where it's created by the two senators. It's been used by 45 years to identify candidates for appointments for, U.S. attorney, judicial appointments, those kinds of things. There are six members of that body, three picked by Tammy Baldwin, three by Ron Johnson. You have to get, I think, five of the six to back you to then go to the next stage of, here's those candidates to go to the White House for an appointment. They convened this commission last year for U.S. attorney in the Western District, in Madison, and Eastern in Milwaukee. Nobody got a consensus of five people. So there was nobody to be U.S. attorney. In November, Pam Bondi, the U.S. attorney general, made Schimmel the interim 120-day appointment. To extend him, he needed to get the federal judges on the Eastern District to say, yeah, we want you to stick around. They basically said no. They want the commission to find somebody to replace him permanently. Now, lots of layers and moving pieces here. On the one hand, the commission, which Tammy Baldwin says, I want to get fired up again. Ron Johnson, I'll work with you on it. Can they find a consensus candidate for a nomination? There's a thing called the blue slip in the U.S. Senate, where not for appeals court ruling or appointments, but for like lower courts and U.S. attorney, if you're the home state senator, you have to return your blue slip that appointment to go forward. If Schimmel had even gotten the five of the six and become a candidate and was nominated, there's no way that Baldwin would return that, because he ran for state Supreme Court last year, fully embraced Trump and Elon Musk. And Baldwin, in fact, last week called for him not to be extended as U.S. attorney. So where do we go from here? Right now, the option is for the office, the U.S. Attorney's Office in Milwaukee, to elevate somebody. But I've been researching this. There are other cases where the Trump administration tried to find a way around this entire thing. So in California, for example, there was a guy who was appointed interim. They tried to extend him because the judges didn't sign off, and like made him part of the office and elevated him again. Judge said no, but you can stay. You can't be the interim going forward, but you can stay overseeing the office. So is there a way for Bondi to get Schimmel back in this office? That's what I'm watching go forward. Ron Johnson said, use every utility you have to extend him. I asked US DOJ, what might you be able to do? Their response was, judges aren't going to pick our attorneys, like rogue judges kind of thing. So it's like, okay. But watch for some other piece to fall in the Schimmel puzzle about what's his future going to look like.
Right. Once again, the sort of ongoing politicization of the courts, and we see that in the way that both Tammy Baldwin and Ron Johnson talk about it. So Tammy Baldwin, we need to get back to the nominating process, not allow the Trump administration to skirt the law in our Wisconsin way of doing things. Ron Johnson, I urge the commissioners not to inject partisan politics into their important work. So again, this kind of push-pull of which side is on the side of truth and the law and order, and which side is very partisan. Well, it depends on which side you're on.
Yeah.
Looking ahead to the Senate next week, they are supposed to wrap up. We are looking at maybe a couple long days. We will see. But one of the really interesting questions that came up this week is about name, image, likeness deals in sports. I think we have to give some disclosure to start, which is that you are a Hoosier, and I learned what a football is last week. So I learned a lot about sports by covering the story. But essentially, college athletes are no longer really considered amateurs. They can get paid. This has kind of opened up the door for Big Ten schools like UW-Madison to be paying their athletes. And so this is a bill that would give $14.5 million a year to UW-Madison, sort of a nominal amount to UW-Milwaukee and Green Bay, I believe, for facilities, which would open up an amount of money for them to work out these deals with student athletes. I think the idea is that right now student athletes can follow the money in a way that they couldn't do before. And this is meant to open that up. And passed almost unanimously in the assembly. But then it went before the Joint Finance Committee before heading to the Senate. And it did not have, it lost the votes of three Republican senators, which means that it will not have a majority vote in the Senate. But it is a Devin Lemahue bill. And so now the really big question is, does he spike his own bill to avoid working with Democrats, or are we going to see some sort of bipartisan compromise here?
So, onion story here. All right. So first layer, rule of 17. It is a rule in the Senate that you only want to pass bills if you have enough votes from your own caucus to do them. Now, Devin Lemahue told one of my a luncheon that we had that it doesn't exist, which is kind of funny to people in the Capitol because it has been enforced somewhat sporadically. Depends on the situation. Like if you're the majority leader and it's your bill you want to get passed, maybe you kind of bend the rule for that. Full disclosure, Indiana graduate, reigning national champions, by the way, in football. So when I say this, not as an Indiana grad, but realist, Republican lawmakers in Wisconsin have not wanted to give UW money for anything for years, going back to Walker years. The football team all of a sudden is mediocre, and they're giving them $15 million a year to free up money to pay for athletes. I mean, that's the reality of the situation. That's what Teston, Pat Teston, Julian Bradley, and Ralph Staff all told me after the joint finance hearing was, hey, we're concerned about basically taxpayers paying out. Now, it's not a taxpayer dollar going to an athlete, but when you put it in the mix, you are subsidizing these NIL deals. Don't forget, Chris Kapinga, another Republican, in a different committee this week, voted against the bill as well. So now you're at 18 minus 4, 14. Okay, two Democrats on finance voted against the bill, so they're not going to get it from Kelda Royce or LaTonya Johnson. You know, there's a sentiment of among Democrats of we want to give UW money, but not necessarily athletics. It did, though, get Mark Spreitzer and Bob Wirch, Beloit and Pleasant Prairie, they voted for it in committee. So, okay, there's at least two Democrats you get. And, you know, let's face it, it's the Badgers, right? So you're probably going to find a few Democrats going to vote for helping the Badgers with this. But does Devin put it on the floor? And then when does he do it? Because remember, we haven't been told officially what they're going to be on the floor, but everybody tells me it's going to be the 17th on Tuesday. It's your last day of the floor. There are like 180 bills you take up. Do you knock out, we call them cats and dogs in this business, like the lower level ones, not controversial. And then at the very end, decide, am I going to put this on the floor for a vote? This, PFAS, you know, the online gaming bill, like what's my list going to be? Am I going to blow up my caucus essentially over something like this? Now, Steve Noss, Republican Whitewater, is retiring. He's knowing a lot of stuff. He might propose a bunch of amendments too, by the way, if you try to do these things that make your caucus uncomfortable, because Steve wants to make a point. Like, we should not be blowing off four or five members to pass bills if we're part of the caucus and don't like them. So, I mean, there's going to be some drama. First thing, see the calendar on Monday. Now, you can be put on the floor without being on the calendar. So if this bill's not on the calendar on Monday, you should pull it to the floor with consent from the chamber. You have to have, I think, two-thirds vote, depending on how you do it, two-thirds consent. So don't freak out if you see the calendar money. This isn't on their online game. They're still on away. But will Lemahue pull those levers to get it done? It's one thing to break the rule 17, like in the last day of session before y'all go away for a while. It's another do it like in the spring before you take up a budget. Like that's a much longer like grind, right? So they may say the heck with it. Let's do it, get this thing done and get out of here. Now, interesting to note, Lemahue also co-authored the Roper bill, right of first refusal. It's this big bill that was, big controversial bill among conservatives to allow utilities with existing infrastructure, the right of first refusal, build new power lines. That lacked 17 votes in his caucus, didn't put on the floor. So there's an example where he stuck by that rule. Will he apply it to this bill? We'll see.
We'll see, and it is really the most interested I have been in college sports in my entire life, so will be a lot to look out for. That brings us to the stock report, and rising this week are liberals on the Supreme Court.
So let's talk about like what's happening going forward, okay? So one, you look at the money for like the 2026 race and what's happening. Look, miracles do happen, but Lazar is a definite disadvantage right now in this race. Liberals are already lining up for 2027. Like I know Pedro Colon, the appeals court judge in Milwaukee, he gave me a statement through his campaign that he's focused on Chris Taylor. After that, if she wins, then he'll think about running. He's going to run. All right, Lindsay Burnett Booth is a judge in Clark County. She's a sitting female judge and former prosecutor that has worked for Jill Karofsky, Rebecca Dallet, Janet Protasiewicz, and Susan Crawford. There's a pattern there. And she's from Clark County. A unicorn is one Democrat told me this week. You know, like, that's pretty impressive. She's probably going to run. Others will kick the tires for sure on this race. They're all jazzed up because they're seeing, hey, we can win this spring and get it to 5-2 and then win in 27, it'd be 6-1. That would guarantee liberals the majority through at least 2023, or 2033, I'm sorry. That also covers drawing new maps in 2031. So whatever happens with that challenge, the maps we currently have, there'll be a census in 2030, be new maps in 31. The Supreme Court would be a backstop. If Republicans win back a trifecta in 2030, I don't say it wouldn't matter, but the court would be a backstop for Democrats to have those new maps. They're all jazzed up. I asked conservatives, who's your candidate for 2027? They went, we don't know. Anthony LaCocco, for example, is a conservative attorney, worked at Wisconsin Institute of Law and Liberty, well-liked in the conservative community. He's unopposed for an appeals court judgeship in the 2nd District in April. It's hard to go from being a judge for like 3 months to a Supreme Court candidate. Maybe you wait until Dallet in 28 or, you know, Kurofsky in 30. There's probably a circuit court judge somewhere who'd be interested, but Shelley Grogan's on the appeals court in Waukesha. She's up in 2027. Give your seat to run for Supreme Court. Do you want to do that? And they're also going, who'd want to do it in this environment where we just are getting our butts kicked, losing by 10 points, 4 or 5 races, don't have the resources or the infrastructure? It's not a great look. Whereas liberals are going, we've got all these things going in our favor. We've got people, we've got resources, we've got infrastructure, and we have the environment. Remember that Marquette poll? We'll get a new one March 30th. The last one, a little early to ask the Supreme Court for ads fired up, but there's a really telling number in there. If you asked Democrats, are they excited to vote, are definitely going to vote in April versus Republicans, about a 6-point gap, which tells us the enthusiasm gap. The spring electorate now is like +5 to +6 for Democrats from day one. You add in Donald Trump and what's going on over in Iran and all these other issues, it's like jet fuel for the Democratic turnout machine. So again, this spring looks pretty, miracles happen, but pretty good for Taylor right now. And 27 is a lifetime away. But you'd have to say, if you're looking, projecting forward, that you're in better shape as a liberal than a conservative on the Supreme Court right now.
Mixed is Priscilla Prado, the third Milwaukee Democrat to draw a primary opponent.
Now, these races, these primaries may not affect the majority come November because there are 3 deep blue seats. But if Democrats win the majority, they could affect if they can actually govern in the assembly come November or January when they take office. So Prado, and this one is all personality driven. So Ryan Clancy, talked about him before. He got primary 2 years ago, another one again this time. He's alienated some people because of comments about the conflict between Israel and Palestine and other issues. Sylvia Ortiz-Velez, she's on the outs of the caucus. She actually left the Democratic caucus because she kind of sort of said about shooting some of them, something like that, and there's all this back and forth and drama. She actually is in court today, pleading no contest to disorderly conduct for threatening to tell bad things about a colleague, a journalist, got a $300 fine. She has a primary. Now Priscilla has one, and the person who's challenging her is on the Milwaukee school board, and when she announced on Facebook this week formally, Sylvia praised the announcement, saying like, I'm really excited for this. This is all the makings of like a little bit of a personal feud, okay? So again, they're all deep blue seats. Whoever wins, you know, they're probably in August, probably gonna win November. But if Democrats get 50 seats, you empower every single member to be like the deciding vote on everything. And if you're Sylvia, you've left the caucus. You're not gonna become a Republican. She said she wouldn't do that, but you come back to the Democrats. Again, if you're, and we're a lot of ifs, but I'm trying to paint a picture of the challenge they would face at 50. If you're Ryan Clancy, he's a member of the Democratic Socialists of America. It means he wants things to be farther left than what most Democrats do. You empower him to say, I need you to do this, this, and this, or I'm not voting for the bill. And if he doesn't vote for it, you can't pass it. So what I'm getting at is this is going to be, there's a challenge to get to 50 votes in the first place for Democrats. This could complicate what that caucus looks like come January if they get to, now, the caveat is, if it's a really good year for Democrats and they win, like, reach seats, get some breathing room, okay, maybe. Look at Robin Voss, Assembly Speaker, outgoing Assembly Speaker. He really wanted to get to 53 seats because that gave him breathing room. That's why it's so important that Dean Coffert run in Neenah, which is a seat that Harris won in 24. Jesse Rodriguez in Milwaukee suburbs, another Harris seat. Todd Novak out in Dodgeville, another Harris seat, because that gave him room that the ones who didn't like him, he could lose a couple, three, and still get to 50 votes. So something to watch this fall.
And then falling is vaccination rates, which continue to literally fall.
Down again. Look, it's what's going on nationally. It's happening here. Now, in Wisconsin, we've been a little below before, but this is being driven by what's happening with RFK Jr. and everything else. It's just another decline. And oh, by the way, hit measles, like two cases this year. So just something to watch going forward.
And we will do just that. But for that now, that will do it for Rewind. I am Anyvan Wagtendonk.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
See you next week.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.